the spice and the sweets, and they give importance to both of them. Now, what does the Quran say in this regard? The Quran states that there are people who, when calamity befall them, they are either impatient or they are patient or they just wait. They are among the people who wait. Now, the first example, those people who are impatient, إِذَا مَسَّهُ الشَّرُّ جَزُوعًا, and when they feel the pain or they go through evil, they are impatient. إِذَا مَسَّهُ الشَّرُّ جَزُوعًا. And now, those who are patient, وَبَشِّرِ الصَّابِرِينَ الَّذِينَ إِذَا أَصَابَتْهُمْ مُصِيبَةٌ. Okay, give good tidings to the patient, to those who are patient, and who, when disaster strikes them, say, indeed we belong to Allah, and indeed to Him we will return. And then there's another group of people who just wait. وَمِنْهُمْ مَنْ يَنْتَظِرُ, of course. So these three groups of people are there. And of course, from bitter and harsh experiences, we can, obviously with patience and good management and seeking help from Allah, we can achieve the best of results and reap the best fruits, just as with sour lemonade can be made. In fact, a good chef can even make jam out of the peel of oranges. Today, even rubbish can be put to good use. Now, we know from history also that Imam Sajjad alayhi salatu wasalam went up on the pulpit and powerfully impeached the regime of Bani Umayyad. Yazid ibn Muawiyah, of course, actually ordered the caller for prayers to recite loudly, to recite the azan or the call to prayer, so as to cut the speech off and hope that Imam Sajjad would be silenced and his words would not be heard. Yet the Imam turned the tables and proceeded to comment on each of the words of the adhan until the entire mosque was left shaking, especially with the words Ashhadu anna Muhammadan Rasulullah, where he reminded Yazid of a powerful fact. Oh Yazid, is this Muhammad my grandfather or yours? When, of course, when the azan was being said, because he, Imam Sajjad alayhi salatu wasalam, used every word of the azan to attack the Bani Umayyad dynasty. Are these prisoners of war not the descendants of the Prophet? This was the argument put forth by Imam Zain al-Abidin alayhi salatu wasalam. So, also there is another example, the example of Imam Kazim alayhi salatu wasalam, when he was thrown into solitary confinement in prison. He said that, what a wonderful place for worship, of course. Solitary confinement is the best place for worshiping God, and he used that as an opportunity. He turned the table. Of course, the Abbasids wanted to torture him, wanted to give him pain, but he said, it's such a good place for worship. And of course, many scholars have authored books about such topics, about sabr, about patience, about making use of the difficult experiences. Inshallah, this would suffice us. Thank you very much. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Your mercy, your love is all I need. So I need. So I need. All I need. Oh, oh, oh. Your love is all I need. Love is all I need.
In the limelight.
Humanity's destruction of nature has made an estimated 2 in 5 plant species worldwide at risk of extinction. According to an assessment published recently by the Royal Botanic Gardens, Kew, in the UK. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Jessica Corbett Ryder. This article is published under the heading New Global Report Warns Nearly 40% of Plants at Risk of Extinction. Here's the details of this article. Humanity's destruction of nature has made an estimated 2 in 5 plant species worldwide at risk of extinction, according to an assessment published recently by the Royal Botanic Gardens, Kew, in the UK. The fourth annual report, entitled State of the World's Plants and Fungi, draws on the expertise of 210 researchers from 42 countries for what Professor Alexander Antonelli, Director of Science at RBGQ, calls an unparalleled collaborative effort that aims to put the planet and all its inhabitants on a more sustainable path. Open your fridge, peek into your medicine cupboard, examine your living room, feel your clothes. For thousands of years, we have searched nature to satisfy our hunger, cure our diseases, build our houses and make our lives more comfortable, Antonelli writes in the report's introduction. But our early exploration of useful traits in the species relied on rudimentary tools, and indigenous knowledge was lost as local traditions were downplayed and globalization emerged, he adds. As a result, humanity is still a long way from utilizing the full potential of biodiversity, in particular plants and fungi, which play critical roles in ecosystems. Now, more than ever before, we need to explore the solutions they could provide to the global challenges we face. The report comes on the heels of a United Nations assessment that the international community has failed to fulfill any of the biodiversity targets that were set a decade ago, as well as the latest edition of Worldwide Fund for Nature's flagship publication, which warned that nature, our life support system, is declining at a staggering rate. Specifically, WWF found an average 68% decrease in population sizes of mammals, birds, amphibians, reptiles, and fish between 1970 and 2016. Throughout the report's 12 chapters, researchers address the importance of seeking out species before they disappear and calculating extinction risks, ways that plants and fungi can be used in terms of food, energy, healthcare, and more, how biological resources can be used more wisely, and the conditions in the UK and its territories. Natural ecosystems provide the useful services for humanity, such as regulating climate, preventing floods, and filtering water. As the building blocks of ecosystems, plants and fungi have the potential to help us address current environmental challenges, such as climate change, the report notes. However, these natural benefits could be compromised by biodiversity loss caused by humans clearing or degrading natural vegetation and overharvesting wild species, as well as by shifting weather patterns. Given the importance of plants and fungi, we need to have a rough idea of the conservation status of every species. Imar Nice, Lugada, conservation scientist at RBGQ and lead author of Extinction Chapter, explained in a statement. Lugada highlighted advancements with artificial intelligence, citing, "The techniques are good enough to say this area has a lot of species that haven't been assessed but are almost certainly threatened." In 2019 alone, 1,942 plants and 1,8800 fungi were scientifically named for the first time, according to the report, which adds that current threats to global biodiversity from climate change, logging, and land use change make the task of cataloging species a race against time. Only 6 species of medicinal fungi have been assessed for conservation status, one of which, Fomitopsis, a wood-inhabiting parasitic fungus, has already been pushed to the brink of extinction, the report says. Out of 25,791 known medicinal plants, 5,411 have been assessed and 723, or 13%, are threatened. Professor Monique Simmons, Deputy Director of Science at RBGQ and lead author of the commercialization chapter, told The Guardian that humanity should look to nature for treating coronavirus and other diseases with pandemic potential. As she put it, "I'm absolutely sure going forward that some of the leads for the next generation of drugs in this area will come from plants and fungi." The report also notes that even though there are at least 7,039 plants that hold potential as foods, just 15 crop plants contribute to 90% of humanity's energy intake, and more than 4 billion people rely on just rice, maize, and wheat. As an RBGQ statement explained, relying on a handful of crops to feed the global population has contributed to malnutrition and left us vulnerable to climate change. Stefano Padulosico, author of Food Chapter, said, "The thousands of underutilized and neglected plant species are the lifeline to millions of people on Earth, tormented by unprecedented climate change, pervasive food and nutrition insecurity, and economic disempowerment. Harnessing this basket of untapped resources for making food and production systems more diverse and resilient to change should be our moral duty to current and future generations," declared Padulosi, former senior scientist at the Alliance of Biodiversity International and the International Center for Tropical Agriculture. Antonelli agreed, saying broadly that the data emerging from this year's report paints a picture of a world that has turned its back on the potential of plants and fungi to address fundamental global issues such as food security and climate change. "Societies have been too dependent on too few species for so long. At a time of rapid biodiversity loss, we are failing to access the treasure chest of incredible diversity on offer and missing a huge opportunity for our generation," he added. "As we start the most critical decade our planet has ever faced, we hope this report will give the public, businesses, and policymakers the facts they need to demand nature-based solutions that can address the triple threats of climate change, biodiversity loss, and food security," end quote.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
In the name of Allah, dear brothers and sisters, salam. So welcome to this program entitled Lantern. As you know, we have an interesting story at the beginning of the program. Today's story is organ donation. One of the richest and most powerful men in Brazil made waves when he announced plans to bury his $1 million Bentley so he could drive around the afterlife in style. He received lots of media attention and was criticized for the extravagant gesture. Why wouldn't he donate the car to charity? How out of touch with reality is this guy? He still went ahead with the ceremony, but there is a twist. Of course, there is. Why else would we be covering this story? To create awareness of organ donation. People condemn me because I wanted to bury $1 million Bentley. In fact, most people bury something a lot more valuable than my car, he said during a speech at the ceremony. They bury hearts, livers, lungs, eyes, kidneys. This is absurd. So many people waiting for a transplant, and you will bury your healthy organs that will save so many lives.
The process begins with an individual or their family agreeing to donate their organs. In most cases, organ donors are patients who've died in hospital, who've been declared brain dead, where all brain activity has definitely and irreversibly stopped. Their organs are then artificially maintained using a ventilator. Organs suitable for this type of donation are the lungs, heart, liver, kidneys, pancreas, intestines, and uterus. Doctors can also remove tissue from corneas, skin, heart valves, veins, arteries, tendons or bones. Bone marrow can also be transplanted, although it must come from a living donor. The time frame possible between tissue removal and transplantation is as little as 3 to 4 hours for a heart or 24 to 36 hours for a kidney. Transplant material is transported in airtight ice boxes which must be kept below 4 degrees Celsius. The recipient is chosen according to their compatibility with the donor, regarding blood and tissue type, or a similar morphology or immune system. That's because the introduction of a foreign organ into the body causes the immune system to react as if under threat and attack it. To avoid rejection of the newly transplanted organ, doctors use medicine to suppress the recipient's immune system. Transplants are extremely delicate. The organ is reconnected to the circulatory system and slowly warmed to enable it to function again.
Dr. Fakhr Rohani.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim wa bin astain. One of the good and humanistic job that one may do is to sign a contract or a paper or a document that after his or her death, some parts of his body, his or her body, to be dedicated to a patient who needs those body organs. For example, when a person signs such an agreement or contract in that after his or her death, for example, his heart or, for example, his liver, his or her liver, to be dedicated to a patient, this is a good job, and by doing so, he or she would save the life of someone else. As we know, there are many illnesses in which some people may need another body organ to be transplanted in them. For example, when someone, owing to an injury, someone cannot live in a normal way, but rather, with the help of some medical devices, he's alive, just alive, without any sense or sensation or without any reaction. If such a person had signed this contract or, this type of, document, that in such cases his body organs, which can be transplanted from his body organ to the body organ of someone else, to someone else who may need such a type of help or transplantation, this is a good job, because in this way the life of a patient who is about to die would save. His or her life would be saved. This is a good practice because some people may think that while they have got some sick people among them about whose life there would be no more hope to be saved. In this case, we find that some medical doctors may suggest that, for example, a certain body organ should be transplanted in the body of the injured person, in the body of the sick person.
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story, which indicates a moral aspect of our life.
At the same time, we find that medical doctors usually, but not in most cases, but medical doctors usually try to do their best, as best as they can. At the same time, we find that some people may receive some money in return for doing this kind of, transplantation or, for doing so. Now we find that there's no age limit. For example, a body organ of an adult person may be transplanted in the body of a sick, another sick person. At the same time, we find that there are medical limitations because of some genetic differences between people or some blood group differences among people. Some people may not be able to receive such kind of transplantation. But all in all, doing this transplantation would save the life of another patient person. But at the same time, some people may say that after this transplantation, the body of the person from whom a body organ has been taken out may be deformed, but it isn't true. The point is that the body of this person would receive just some stitches in the place from where a certain body organ has been taken out.
The same when I'm
to consent by what they say. Why should I wanna have you? To doubt you would be the worst mistake. Deep inside I know, amidst all the darkness and everything which makes no sense, I know that you exist. Guides me through my darkest nights, shows me right from wrong in a world that often lies. Cause I don't need anyone.
In the limelight. Myanmar's armed forces, known as the Tatmadaw, are notorious for committing rights abuses with impunity, most notably following a brutal 2017 crackdown on Rakhine State's mostly Muslim Rohingya minority that sent 740,000 fleeing across the border to Bangladesh. A United Nations Independent International Fact-Finding Mission stated in a September 2019 report that Myanmar was failing in its obligation to prevent, investigate or enact effective legislation criminalizing and punishing genocide in relation to its treatment of the Rohingya Muslim minority. We now present you an article written jointly by Emily Fishbein and Kyo Hassan Hliang under the heading In Myanmar's Rakhine, Families of the Disappeared Seek Answers. The article has been taken from the AlJazeera.com website. Please stay with us for more of Emily Fishbein and Kyo Hassan Hliang's article. One evening, as Mon Away and her family were having dinner, soldiers from Myanmar's armed forces, known as the Tatmadaw, came to her house and asked for her husband. According to her account, they blindfolded him, took out their guns and beat him in front of her. Mon Away, an ethnic Arakanese from Myanmar's westernmost Rakhine state, who prefers not to reveal her real identity for fear of reprisals, said, "At the time, I could only cry," she added. "I feared they would shoot me, so I held my tongue. I felt like they were the most brutal people in the world." It was 16th of March 2020, and the last time she saw her husband. He's among 18 people from the neighboring villages of Tinmatit and Tinmagi in Rakhine State's northern Kyoktau township, who were arrested in March of 2020 and have not been seen ever since. Their families' relentless search for information has been met with silence, rejection and threats. 10 months later, they're still looking for answers and they're looking for justice. Three witnesses, whose testimonies align with those published by other media, told Al Jazeera that on 13th of March and 16th of March, uniformed soldiers wearing the badge of the Tatmadaw's Light Infantry Division No. 55 went door-to-door arresting dozens of men. It's suspected of having ties to the Arakan Army, an ethnic group seeking autonomy. Some of those arrested were released the same day, but 18 individuals were not released. The missing include a 16-year-old teenage boy, three people over the age of 65, and one person who is deaf. Al Jazeera has used pseudonyms for the three witnesses to protect them from possible reprisals. On 18th of March 2020, four bodies were seen floating in the Caladan River near the villages. One of the bodies was identified by family members as among the missing villagers. The family told local media that soldiers shot at them when they approached the body floating in the river, which the US government-funded broadcaster Radio Free Asia reported was riddled with bullet holes. The three other bodies were never identified. All of the missing are Arakanese, also called Rakhine, a predominantly Buddhist ethnic group thought to make up the majority in the state. Frustrated with political marginalization and perceived domination under Myanmar's ethnic Bamar majority, increasing numbers of Arakanese have in recent years joined the Arakan army to fight for their legal rights, which were violated in their country. Since conflict escalated in late 2018, nearly 1,000 civilians have been killed or seriously injured in violence, including indiscriminate air raids, gunfire and landmines, and more than 230,000 have fled their homes. The arrests in Tinmagi and Tinmatit villages occurred following 2 weeks of intense clashes near the villages. Tunhala, who was among those arrested and released, said, "The Tatmadaw soldiers went house to house calling the men." He added, "I don't know why we were arrested by the Tatmadaw. At the time, the soldiers didn't give any reason. 10 people were tied and beaten with guns in front of me. Days later, the villagers fled." Zorwin, a local advocate helping the families of the missing to seek justice, told Al Jazeera that three elderly men stayed in Tinmagi village to watch over the monastery and have also not been seen ever since. Shortly after the villagers were deserted, the houses were razed. Villagers blamed the Tatmadaw soldiers, which have denied responsibility. Myanmar's police forces are under the control of the Ministry of Home Affairs, which itself is under the jurisdiction of the Tatmadaw. On 23rd of March, a group of family members of the missing, now scattered in different displacement camps, filed a case regarding the disappearances with township police. Letters were also sent to the Myanmar National Human Rights Commission and the offices of the Commander-in-Chief, President and State Councillor, calling for an investigation into the disappearances. No updates came until June of 2020, when a Tatmadaw spokesperson denied anyone had been arrested in the two villages. 5 more months of silence followed. On 27th of November, the Tatmadaw spokesperson announced that the families could open a case at the relevant police station, and that if the police reported any suspicious information, the Tatmadaw would decide whether to conduct its own investigation. The families returned to the township police station on 8th of December, but Ma Nuwei told Al Jazeera the police officers on duty warned them against opening a case. She said, "Regarding the initial case, the police told us their paperwork disappeared," adding, "Then they threatened us several times that we could be detained and sent to jail." So Win, who accompanied the villagers to the police station, noted, "They said this case doesn't concern them and we should go to the Tatmadaw station to inquire," adding, "When we replied that the police had a responsibility to seek justice, they said they could immediately detain us and send us to jail." The Myanmar National Human Rights Commission, which has faced criticism for not intervening in other high-profile cases, has also done little to support the Tinmah villagers. Choctaw Township legislator Tun Nguyen, who submitted the request to investigate the case, told Al Jazeera the commission responded in November that the Tin Ma villagers were not detained by the Tatmadaw. Its chairperson told local media on December 30th that the pandemic prevented an on-site investigation and that the commission had closed the case after inquiring with the defense ministry, which denied that the Tatmadaw had any involvement. A police investigation finally began on 29th of December when district police in the nearby town of Murukyu called the villagers in for questioning. Ma Nwei stayed behind out of fear. She said, "I feel like my children and we are not safe since my husband disappeared. I'm really worried we could be attacked because we filed charges." According to Radio Free Asia, the police took statements from 15 people. The next day, the Tatmadaw spokesperson stated that concerned individuals could file reports and present credible evidence with the local military division office or regional military commanders. Al Jazeera's calls to the Tatmadaw spokesperson, township and district police stations, Myanmar's National Human Rights Commission, and Rakhine State government spokesperson all went unanswered. Media are only allowed to report from Rakhine with permission and official escort, and the government has restricted mobile internet services across conflict-affected townships, including the township of Choctaw, since June of 2019. Local lawyer Zul Win told Al Jazeera he was frustrated by an apparent lack of political will to address the case. He said, "All authorities have to take responsibility," he added. "Those in power need to know the situation, follow human rights standards and seek justice." The Tatmadaw is notorious for committing human rights abuses with impunity, most notably following a brutal 2017 crackdown on Rakhine State's mostly Muslim Rohingya minority that sent 740,000 people fleeing into neighboring Bangladesh. A United Nations Independent International Fact-Finding Mission stated in a September 2019 report that Myanmar was failing in its obligation to prevent, investigate, or enact effective legislation criminalizing and punishing genocide in relation to its treatment of the Rohingya Muslim minority. The fact-finding mission also, in an August 2018 report, identified enforced disappearances among crimes against humanity committed in Kachin, Rakhine State, and Shan states, for which Myanmar's top military generals must be investigated and prosecuted. The Tin Ma villagers' cases are not the only enforced disappearances to have occurred in Rakhine State since the report was released. According to a tally by the Rakhine-based development media group, between January and June of 2020, at least 30 civilians disappeared in the state of Rakhine after being arrested by the Tatmadaw. As of October, Radio Free Asia counted 32 more who have died after being taken into Tatmadaw custody from the start of 2019 to October 12th of 2020. In April of 2020, UN human rights expert Yang Yi Li said accountability was critical to ending the crackdown by the Tatmadaw. She said in a statement, "Having faced no accountability, the Tatmadaw soldiers continue to operate with impunity," adding, "They are now targeting all civilians in the conflict area. Their crimes must be investigated in accordance with international standards, with perpetrators being held accountable." Miu Myat Hien, the chair of the Arakan Lawyers Council, which is providing legal aid to the families of the missing Tin Ma villagers, also emphasized the importance of accountability. He said, "It isn't acceptable just to say the villagers are missing because several people saw the Tatmadaw soldiers detain them." He added, "Conflict actors need to build trust beyond just talking about the national peace process." Tun Nguyen, the Choctaw Township legislator, emphasizes the urgency of achieving justice for the Tin Ma villagers and others affected by human rights abuses in the state of Rakhine. He said, "If the perpetrators of these crimes have impunity, it will be difficult to achieve sustainable justice." Ma Nwei said she lies sleepless at night, worrying about her husband and fearing for her and her children's safety and survival. They were unable to harvest their paddy fields this season and are living on 15,000 kyats, or roughly $11 a month, in food aid. Manwei wants to go home but still fears that the Tatmadaw soldiers stationed near her village. She said, as long as they're staying there, we won't be safe.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, neither flattery nor envy. Flattery and compliments both offer words of praise to another person. However, flattery is not always seen as good. While offering another person a compliment generally has positive connotation. The difference between flattery and compliments lies in the intent of the person offering such praise and whether he expects anything in return or not. Flattery means false or excessive praise. Complimenting, on the other hand, means offering respect or admiration of the other person. See, we, being a social being living in a human society, of course there are some things that we feel attracted towards. There are certain qualities that we feel like that there's a need to be praised, the doer of those or the possessor of those qualities. There is no harm in it. You should praise others. But remember, there's a fine line between praising someone and flattery. These two are different things. And the difference is that for someone who is a flatterer and is flattering someone, the state of their heart is different than someone who is praising, genuinely praising someone else. Okay? So if you are after some sort of like self-interest, and based on that self-interest, you feel compelled to praise someone, know that you may be crossing over the line. This is what may qualify to be flattery. Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are discussing neither flattery nor envy. Before the break, we talked about what is the difference between complimenting someone, praising someone, and flattery. We know that praising someone is good in Islam, you know, respecting someone because of a positive trait, a quality, a divine quality they may have, or a responsibility that they're carrying out. Praising them for that is good. But at the same time, Islam discourages us from doing flattery to other people. When we have these hidden agenda in our mind, in our heart, but on our tongue, we are actually praising that person, there is something wrong there, right? There's that negativity that you may want to watch out for. Now, flattery makes use of a person's need to be praised or to have his ego stroked. A flatterer can use this need to manipulate others into doing his bidding. Flattery tells an angry man how wonderful he is for being strong and knowing what he wants, or tells a jealous woman how great it is that she is protecting her relationship with her husband. So see, like, you have to be very careful and know where the line of flattery draws. Envy is also one of the deadly sins in Roman Catholicism. In the book of Genesis, envy is said to be the motivation behind Cain murdering his brother Abel. And Cain envied Abel because God favored Abel's sacrifice over Cain's. Envy is among the things that comes from the heart, defiling a person. So, you know, this famous story of Habil and Qabil, Abel and Cain, you know, that is based on envy as well. So see how far the effects of envy can be detrimental to you. This is why Islam says that when praise and commendation is more than merited and deserved, it is flattery. And when less than merited, it is either debility in expression or envy. So watch out. Neither be envious nor be a flatterer. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Diverse range of programs, spirituality, youth, Eastern tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The Europeans' empty promises after the U.S. withdrew from the JCPOA.
This is part of a televised speech delivered on July 31st, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the supreme leader of the Islamic Revolution on the occasion of Eid al-Adha.
Since long ago, there has been enmity against domestic independence. Also, on the issue of the nationalization of oil industry, as soon as the Iranian nation managed to stand on its own feet, the Americans and the English created the event of the 28th of Mordad. After the revolution too, they have been creating all kinds of problems. Therefore, we should pay attention that this matter, national self-sufficiency, has serious enemies. We should not take heed of others' promises either. I have said this before, but I wish to repeat it again. In early 1397, 2 years ago, the U.S. had withdrawn from the Barjam, JCPOA, and we kept saying that the Europeans should do this and that. They said, okay, but you should wait 3-4 months.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
After the passage of 4 months, they said that we should wait 5-6 more months. They kept prolonging the process. In other words, they conditioned the country's economy and rendered it dependent. Our investors, our businessmen, our exporters, and our economic activists waited impatiently to see whether Europe would do anything or not. This is really detrimental to the economy of the country. We should not trust in their promises because they do not honor them. We should not make the country wait for this and that decision. We should do our own job.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praise. Praises to Allah, alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to
Around the World with Reporters. Travel agents in 13 different countries should get ready for a rush of customers. The United States has finally lifted its shockingly xenophobic and unprecedented travel ban. Iran was one of 6 other Muslim-majority nations which were primarily targeted, which caused ex-President Donald Trump's executive order to become called the Muslim travel ban, informally and infamously. New President Joe Biden ended the ban on his first day in office. The bigotry lasted 4 years, and the damage to American citizens, countless non-Americans, and America's image cannot be overestimated.
real shame in this is not simply turning our back on, you know, America's tradition of not judging people on the basis of their religion or our constitutional prohibition against that. But what's really, you know, troubling about this is that we have gone through this process where family members have not been able to be together with loved ones.
Husbands and wives have been kept apart for years. Grandparents passed away without seeing their newborn grandchildren. Weddings, graduations, birthdays, funerals, jobs, business deals, educational exchanges. The accumulation of grief and difficulty caused by the Islamophobic ban is appalling. In many ways, the ban backfired because it emphatically demonstrated the scope and reach of state-sponsored Islamophobia, something which had been routinely denied by the right and the left, not only in the United States, but across the West.
It's really going to require that we go through the hard work of actually implementing policies, not just in travel, but in other ways that fight against Islamophobia, because we know that it has been a feature in our society, you know, certainly for the last 30 years, but even long before that.
The ban led to doctor shortages in a United States which would soon be unable to handle the coronavirus pandemic. It also put a pause on the so-called brain drain, which allows America to stay near the forefront of science and technology. Trump's dehumanizing of Muslims followed years of scapegoating in order to rationalize the wars across the Muslim world started by Trump's predecessors, George W. Bush and Barack Obama. Perhaps above all, the ban showed that in the American system, it is still possible to codify racism into law. The Supreme Court reversed a series of lower court decisions which allowed the ban to go into effect. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Slim hopes of progress towards peace in Yemen were swiftly dashed this month as former US President Donald Trump designated Yemen's Houthi Ansarullah movement as a foreign terrorist organization before he left office. A move widely condemned as deeply damaging to the peace process and pushing the country towards a possible new famine. Amid fears for Yemen's future, I secured an exclusive interview with the foreign minister of the Ansarullah-led government in Sana'a for a response to these disturbing developments.
The U.S. is not an international organization or some kind of an institution that has the right to designate someone as terrorist or not terrorist. The U.S. should always be concerned about its affairs, not trying to be the guardian of the whole world.
The foreign minister explained that he felt the U.S. decision was silly and that Trump was probably paid into making the choice.
I think the Trump administration decision was something paid for. And you will see it in the near future. It's something paid for to say certain things or to take some actions. So again, from our side, we are not concerned about that and we will not deal with it.
I asked the foreign minister whether Yemen would consider a military response. He warned that if the peace process totally fails, Yemen is strong enough to fight back.
If such peace fails, we are ready for all circumstances. And our choices are wide open. And by the way, we can affect and do what we want. We are so strong to the point that we can change the whole scenario. But we will not do it for the sake of the Yemeni people.
The foreign minister also sent a message to the new U.S. President Joe Biden.
If Biden has the courage, and I think he does, they should make an announcement that this war is over. They stop the support of the Saudis and the Emiratis and any other people involved, and the war will stop. And Mr. Biden, maybe later on, will get the Nobel Prize that Trump was running after. Now Biden should run after it.
It's been reported that Biden's foreign policy team disagrees with the terror designation and that many of Trump's policies will be reversed in quick succession. But even if the U.S. ends its support for the Saudi coalition's aggression, peace may be unachievable.